Masters, An Overview of the New Physics, by Gary Zukav. This book consists of one chapter and is 314 pages long. The following material appears on the dust jacket of the book. Gary Zukav has written the Bible for those who are curious about the mind-expanding discoveries of advanced physics, but who have no scientific background. Like a Wu Li master who would teach us wonder for the falling petal before speaking of gravity, Zukav writes in beautifully clear language, with no mathematical equations, opening our minds to the exciting new theories that are beginning to embrace the ultimate nature of our universe. Quantum mechanics, relativity, and beyond to the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen effect and Bell's theorem. Dedication. This book is dedicated to you, who are drawn to read it. Acknowledgements. My gratitude to the following people cannot be adequately expressed. I discovered in the course of writing this book that physicists, from graduate students to Nobel laureates, are a gracious group of people, accessible, helpful, and engaging. This discovery shattered my long-held stereotype of the cold, objective scientific personality. For this, above all, I am grateful to the people listed here. Jack Sarfati, Ph.D., director of the Physics Consciousness Research Group, is the catalyst without whom the following people and I would not have met. Al Chung-Liang Huang, the Tai Chi master, provided the perfect metaphor of Wu Li, inspiration, and the beautiful calligraphy. David Finkelstein, Ph.D., director of the School of Physics, Georgia Institute of Technology, was my first tutor. These men are the godfathers of this book. In addition to Sarfati and Finkelstein, Brian Josephson, professor of physics, Cambridge University, and Max Yammer, professor of physics, Bar-Ilan University, Ramat Gan, Israel, read and commented upon the entire manuscript. I am especially indebted to these men, but I do not wish to imply that any one of them or any other of the individualistic and creative thinkers who helped me with this book would approve of it page for page as it is written, nor that the responsibility for any errors or misinterpretations belongs to anyone but me. I am also indebted to Henry Stapp, Ph.D., Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory, for reading and commenting upon portions of the manuscript, and to Elizabeth Rauscher, Ph.D., founder and sponsor of the fundamental physics group, Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory, for encouraging non-physicists to partake of weekly conferences which normally would attract only physicists. In addition to Stapp and Sarfati, this group included John Clauser, Ph.D., Philippe Eberhard, Ph.D., George Weissman, Ph.D., Fred Wolf, Ph.D., and Fritjof Capra, Ph.D., among others. I am grateful to Carson Jeffries, professor of physics, University of California at Berkeley, for his support and for commenting upon portions of the manuscript, to David Baum, professor of physics, Birkbeck College, University of London, for reading portions of the manuscript, to Saul Paul Sirag for his frequent assistance, to the physicists of the Particle Data Group, Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory, for their assistance in compiling the particle table at the back of the book, to Eleanor Criswell, professor of psychology, Sonoma State University, California, for her valuable support, to Jin McCollum, professor of mathematics, Kansas State University, for her assistance and for her patient tutelage, and to Nick Herbert, Ph.D., director of the Sea Life Institute, for providing me with his excellent papers on Bell's theorem and for permission to use his paper title, More Than Both, as a chapter title. All of the illustrations in this book were done by Thomas Lyndon Robinson. Harvey White, Professor Emeritus, Department of Physics, University of California at Berkeley, and former director, Lawrence Hall of Science, personally provided photographs of his famous simulations of probability distribution patterns. The electron diffraction photograph was provided by Ronald Gronsky, Ph.D., Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory. I learned much about spectroscopy from Sumner Davis, professor of physics, University of California at Berkeley. I am deeply grateful to these men who, like all of the physicists that I encountered in writing this book, gave graciously of their time and knowledge to a stranger who needed help. I am also indebted to Maria Guarnaschelli, my editor, for her sensitivity and erudition. Without the generosity of Michael Murphy and the board of directors of the Esalen Institute, which sponsored the 1976 Conference on Physics and Consciousness, none of this probably would have happened. Foreword by David Finkelstein, New York, July 1978. When Gary Zukav announced his plans for this book, creating the outline with Al Huang and me watching at a dinner table at Esalen 1976, I did not realize the magnitude of the job he took on with such joy. Watching the book grow has been instructive and rewarding, because Zukav has insisted on going through the whole evolution of the quantum relativistic physics of today, treating it as it is, an unfolding story. As a result, this book is not only readable, but it also puts the reader in touch with all the various ways that physicists have worked out for talking about what is so hard to talk about. In short, Gary Zukav has written a very good book for laymen. Zukav's attitude to physics is rather close to mine, so I must be a layman too, and it is more stimulating to talk physics with him than with most professionals. He knows that physics is, among other things, an attempt to harmonize with a much greater entity than ourselves, requiring us to seek, formulate, and eradicate first one and then another of our most cherished prejudices and oldest habits of thought in a never-ending quest for the unattainable. Zukav has graciously offered me this place to add my own emphases to his narrative. Since it has been 3 years since we met, I must sift my memory for a while. Migrating whales come to mind first. I remember us standing on the Esalen cliffs and watching them cavort as they headed south. Next comes to mind beautiful monarch butterflies dotting the fields from the first day and covering one magic tree as thick as leaves in a grand finale. Between the whales and the butterflies, it was difficult for us to feel self-important and very easy for us to play. The very difficulty of communicating with the physicists at Esalen helped me to realize how differently most physicists think about quantum mechanics than I do. Not that my way is new. It is one of two ways already pointed out in John von Neumann's 1932 book, The Mathematical Foundation of Quantum Mechanics. 1. Quantum mechanics deals with propositions defined by processes of preparation and observation involving subject and object and obeying a new logic, not with objective properties of the object alone. 2. Quantum mechanics deals with objective properties of the object alone, obeying the old logic, but they jump in a random way when an observation is made. Most working physicists seem to see one of these ways, the second, and not the other. Perhaps personality can determine the direction of science. I think there are thing minds and people minds. Good parents, psychologists, and writers have to be people people, while mechanics, engineers, and physicists tend to be thing people. Physics has become too scary for such physicists because it is already so thingless. New evolutions, as profound as those of Einstein and Heisenberg, are waiting for a new generation of more daring and integrated thinkers. While most physicists take for granted the quantum tools of their daily work, there is a vanguard already testing roads to the next physics, and a rearguard still conscientiously holding the road back to the old. Bell's theorem is mainly important to the latter, and its prominence in the book does not mean it uncovers problems in present-day quantum physics. Rather, Bell's theorem drives toward a view that most physicists already assume, that quantum mechanics is something new and different. Here, it helps to distinguish between a complete theory predicting everything, what Newtonians look for. It does not seem that Newton was a strict Newtonian, since he wanted God to reset the world clock now and then. And a maximal theory predicting as much as possible, what quantum physicists look for. In spite of their controversy, Einstein and Bohr both agreed in their different ways that quantum mechanics is incomplete, and even that it is not yet maximal. What they really debated was whether or not an incomplete theory can be maximal. Throughout their famous controversy, Einstein argued, "Alas, our theory is too poor for experience." And Bohr replied, "No, no, experience is too rich for our theory." Just as some existential philosophers despair at the indeterminacy of life and the existence of choices, and others feel élan vital. One of the features of quantum mechanics that leads to such controversy is its concern with the non-existent, the potential. There is some of this in all language, or words could only be used once, but quantum mechanics is more involved with probabilities than classical mechanics. Some people feel this discredits quantum theory, makes it less than maximal theory. So it is important to mention in defense of quantum theory that in spite of indeterminacy, quantum mechanics can be entirely expressed in yes or no terms about individual experiments, just like classical mechanics, and that probabilities can be derived as a law of large numbers and need not be postulated. I prefer to state the difference between classical and quantum theories, not as presented in textbooks, but thus. Once sufficient data is given, classical mechanics gives yes or no answers for all further questions, while quantum mechanics simply leaves unanswered some questions in the theory to be answered by experience. I wish here also to note the regrettable tendency, in myself also, to feel that quantum mechanics must thereby deny physical existence to those answers that are found in experience only, not in theory, such as the momentum of a localized electron. So involved are we in our symbol systems. After a week of talking, the conference was still working on the elements of quantum logic, and never did get far into the new quantum time concepts we wanted to try out. But it made it easier to move on to the next set of problems, which occupy me today. Quantum mechanics is characterized by its unanswered questions. Some logicians, Martin Davis for one, have suggested these may be related to the undecidable propositions dominating logic since Gödel. I used to know better. Nowadays, I think they may be right, the common element being reflexivity and the impossibility for finite systems of total self-knowledge. The proper study of mankind is endless, it seems. I hope these ideas work out and Gary Zukav writes a book about them. He does it well. Introduction. My first exposure to quantum physics occurred a few years ago when a friend invited me to an afternoon conference at the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory in Berkeley, California. At that time, I had no connections with the scientific community, so I went to see what physicists were like. To my great surprise, I discovered that, one, I understood everything that they said, and two, their discussion sounded very much like a theological discussion. I scarcely could believe what I had discovered. Physics was not the sterile, boring discipline that I had assumed it to be. It was a rich, profound venture which had become inseparable from philosophy. Incredibly, no one but physicists seemed to be aware of this remarkable development. As my interest in and knowledge of physics grew, I resolved to share this discovery with others. This book is a gift of my discovery. It is one of a series. Generally speaking, people can be grouped into two categories of intellectual preference. The first group prefers explorations which require a precision of logical processes. These are the people who become interested in the natural sciences and mathematics. They do not become scientists because of their education. They choose a scientific education because it gratifies their scientific mental set. The second group prefers explorations which involve the intellect in a less logically rigorous manner. These are the people who become interested in the liberal arts. They do not have a liberal arts mentality because of their education. They choose a liberal arts education because it gratifies their liberal arts mental set. Since both groups are intelligent, it is not difficult for members of one group to understand what members of the other group are studying. However, I have discovered a notable communication problem between the two groups. Many times my physicist friends have attempted to explain a concept to me and, in their exasperation, have tried one explanation after another, each one of which sounded to me abstract, difficult to grasp, and generally abstruse. When I could comprehend at last what they were trying to communicate, inevitably I was surprised to discover that the idea itself was actually quite simple. Conversely, I often have tried to explain a concept in terms which seemed to me laudably lucid, but which to my exasperation seemed hopelessly vague, ambiguous, and lacking in precision to my physicist friends. I hope that this book will be a useful translation, which will help those people who do not have a scientific mental set, like me, to understand the extraordinary process which is occurring in theoretical physics. Like any translation, it is not as good as the original work, and, of course, it is subject to the shortcomings of the translator. For better or worse, my first qualification as a translator is that, like you, I am not a physicist. To compensate for my lack of education in physics and for my liberal arts mentality, I asked and received the assistance of an extraordinary group of physicists. They are listed in the acknowledgments. Four of them in particular read the entire manuscript. As each chapter was completed, I sent a copy of it to each physicist and asked him to correct any conceptual or factual errors which he found. Several other physicists read selected chapters. My original intention was to use these comments to correct the text. However, I soon discovered that my physicist friends had given more attention to the manuscript than I had dared to hope. Not only were their comments thoughtful and penetrating, but taken together they formed a significant volume of information by themselves. The more I studied them, the more strongly I felt that I should share these comments with you. Therefore, in addition to correcting the manuscript with them, I also included in the footnotes those comments which do not duplicate the corrected text. In particular, I footnoted those comments which would have slowed the flow of the text or made it technical, and those comments which disagreed with the text and also disagreed with the comments of the other physicists. By publishing dissenting opinions in the footnotes, I have been able to include numerous ideas which would have lengthened and complicated the book if they had been presented in the text. From the beginning of the Dancing Wu Li Masters to the end, no term is used which is not explained immediately before or after its first use. This rule is not followed in the footnotes. This gives the footnotes an unmitigated freedom of expression. However, it also means that the footnotes contain terms that are not explained before, during, or after their use. The text respects your status as newcomer to a vast and exciting realm. The footnotes do not. However, if you read the footnotes as you read the book, you will have the rare opportunity to see what four of the finest physicists in the world have to say about it as they, in effect, read it along with you. Their footnotes punctuate, illustrate, annotate, and jab at everything in the text. Better than it can be described, these footnotes reveal the aggressive precision with which men of science seek to remove the flaws from the work of a fellow scientist, even if he is an untrained colleague like me. And the work is non-technical, like this book. The new physics, as it is used in this book, means quantum mechanics, which began with Max Planck's theory of quanta in 1900, and relativity, which began with Albert Einstein's special theory of relativity in 1905. The old physics is the physics of Isaac Newton, which he discovered about 300 years ago. Classical physics means any physics that attempts to explain reality in such a manner that for every element of physical reality, there is a corresponding element in the theory. Therefore, classical physics includes the physics of Isaac Newton and relativity, both of which are structured in this one-to-one manner. It does not, however, include quantum mechanics, which, as we shall see, is one of the things that makes quantum mechanics unique. Be gentle with yourself as you read. This book contains many rich and multifaceted stories, all of which are heady, pun, stuff. You cannot learn them all at once any more than you can learn the stories told in War and Peace, Crime and Punishment, and Les Misérables all at once. I suggest that you read this book for your pleasure and not to learn what is in it. There is a complete index at the back of the book and a good table of contents in the front. Between the two of them, you can return to any subject that catches your interest. Moreover, by enjoying yourself, you probably will remember more than if you had set about to learn it all. One last note. This is not a book about physics and Eastern philosophies. Although the poetic framework of Wu Li is conducive to such comparisons, this book is about quantum physics and relativity. In the future, I hope to write another book specifically about physics and Buddhism. In view of the Eastern flavor of Wu Li, however, I have included in this book those similarities between Eastern philosophies and physics that seemed to me so obvious and significant that I felt that I would be doing you a disservice if I did not mention them in passing. Happy reading. Gary Zukav, San Francisco, July 1978. Most of the fundamental ideas of science are essentially simple and may, as a rule, be expressed in a language comprehensible to everyone. Albert Einstein. Even for the physicist, the description in plain language will be a criterion of the degree of understanding that has been reached. Werner Heisenberg. If you cannot, in the long run, tell everyone what you have been doing, your doing has been worthless. Erwin Schrödinger. Part 1. Wu Li. Chapter 1. Big Week at Big Sur. When I tell my friends that I study physics, they move their heads from side to side, they shake their hands at the wrist, and they whistle, "Whew, that's difficult." This universal reaction to the word physics is a wall that stands between what physicists do and what most people think they do. There is usually a big difference between the two. Physicists themselves are partly to blame for this sad situation. Their shop talk sounds like advanced Greek unless you are Greek or a physicist. When they are not talking to other physicists, physicists speak English. Ask them what they do, however, and they sound like the natives of Corfu again. On the other hand, part of the blame is ours. Generally speaking, we have given up trying to understand what physicists and biologists, etc., really do. In this, we do ourselves a disservice. These people are engaged in extremely interesting adventures that are not that difficult to understand. True, how they do what they do sometimes entails a technical explanation which, if you are not an expert, can produce an involuntary deep sleep. What physicists do, however, is actually quite simple. They wonder what the universe is really made of, how it works, what we are doing in it, and where it is going, if it is going any place at all. In short, they do the same things that we do on starry nights when we look up at the vastness of the universe and feel overwhelmed by it, and a part of it at the same time. That is what physicists really do, and the clever rascals get paid for doing it. Unfortunately, when most people think of physics, they think of chalkboards covered with undecipherable symbols of an unknown mathematics. The fact is that physics is not mathematics. Physics, in essence, is simple wonder at the way things are, and a divine, some call it compulsive, interest in how that is so. Mathematics is the tool of physics. Stripped of mathematics, physics becomes pure enchantment. I had spoken often to Jack Sarfati, who is the physicist director of the Physics Consciousness Research Group, about the possibility of writing a book, unencumbered with technicalities and mathematics, to explain the exciting insights that motivate current physics. So when he invited me to a conference on physics that he and Michael Murphy were arranging at the Esalen Institute, I accepted with a purpose. The Esalen Institute, it is named for an Indian tribe, is in Northern California. The Northern California coast is an awesome combination of power and beauty, but nowhere so much as along the Pacific Coast Highway between the towns of Big Sur and San Luis Obispo. The Esalen facilities are located about a half hour south of Big Sur, between the highway and the coastal mountains on the one side, and rugged cliffs overlooking the Pacific Ocean on the other. A dancing stream divides the northern third of the grounds from the remainder. On that side is a big house, called the Big House, where guests stay and groups meet, Along with a small home where Dick Price, co-founder of Esalen with Murphy, stays with his family. On the other side of the stream is a lodge where meals are served and meetings are held, accommodations for guests and staff, and hot sulfur baths. Dinner at Esalen is a multi-dimensional experience. The elements are candlelight, organic food, and a contagious naturalness that is the essence of the Esalen experience. Sarfati and I joined two men who already were eating. One was David Finkelstein, a physicist from Yeshiva University in New York, who was attending the conference on physics. The other was Al Chung-Yang Huang, a Tai Chi master who was leading a workshop at Esalen. We could not have chosen better companions. The conversation soon turned to physics. "When I studied physics in Taiwan," said Huang, "we called it Wu Li. It means patterns of organic energy." Everyone at the table was taken at once by this image. Mental lights flashed on one by one as the idea penetrated. Wu Li was more than poetic. It was the best definition of physics that the conference would produce. It caught that certain something, that living quality that we were seeking to express in a book, that thing without which physics becomes sterile. "Let's write a book about Wu Li," I heard myself exclaim. Immediately, ideas and energy began to flow, and in one stroke all of the prior planning that I had done went out the window. From that pooling of energy came the image of the dancing Wu Li masters. My remaining days at Esalen and those that followed were devoted to finding out what Wu Li masters are and why they dance. All of us sensed with excitement and certitude that we had discovered the channel through which the very things that we wanted to say about physics would flow. The Chinese language does not use an alphabet like Western languages. Each word in Chinese is depicted by a character, which is a line drawing. Sometimes two or more characters are combined to form different meanings. This is why it is difficult to translate Chinese into English. Good translations require a translator who is both a poet and a linguist. For example, Wu, W-U, can mean either matter or energy. Li, L-I, is a richly poetic word. It means universal order or universal law. It also means organic patterns. The grain in a panel of wood is li. The organic pattern on the surface of a leaf is also li, and so is the texture of a rose petal. In short, Wu Li, the Chinese word for physics, means patterns of organic energy. Matter slash energy, Wu, plus universal order slash organic patterns, li. This is remarkable, since it reflects a worldview which the founders of Western science, Galileo and Newton, simply did not comprehend, but toward which virtually every physical theory of import in the 20th century is pointing. The question is not, do they know something that we don't? The question is, how do they know it? English words can be pronounced almost any way without changing their meanings. I was 5 years a college graduate before I learned to pronounce consummate as an adjective. It means carried to the utmost extent or degree, perfect. I live in anguish when I think of the times that I have spoken of consummate linguists, consummate scholars, etc. Someone always seemed to be holding back a smile, almost. I learned later that these were the people who read dictionaries. Nonetheless, my bad pronunciation never prevented me from being understood. That is because inflections do not change the denotation of an English word. No, spoken with a rising inflection, no. With a downward inflection, no. And with no inflection, no. All mean, according to the dictionary, a denial, a refusal, negative. This is not so in Chinese. Most Chinese syllables can be pronounced several different ways. Each different pronunciation is a different word which is written differently and which has a meaning of its own. Therefore, the same syllable, pronounced with different inflections, which unaccustomed Western listeners scarcely can distinguish, constitutes distinctly separate words, each with its own ideogram and meaning, to a Chinese listener. In English, which is an atonal language, these different ideograms are all written and pronounced the same way. For example, there are over 80 different wus in Chinese, all of which are spelled and pronounced the same way in English. Al Huang has taken 5 of these wus, each of which, when combined with li, produces a different wu li, each with the same English spelling, and each pronounced in English wu li. The first wu li means patterns of organic energy. This is the Chinese way of saying physics. Wu means matter or energy. The second wu li means my way. Wu means mine or self. The third wu li means nonsense. Wu means void or non-being. The fourth wu li means I clutch my ideas. Wu means to make a fist or clutch with a closed hand. The fifth wu li means enlightenment. Wu means enlightenment or my heart slash my mind. If we were to stand behind a master weaver as he begins to work his loom, we would see at first not cloth, but a multitude of brightly colored threads from which he picks and chooses with his expert eye and feeds into the moving shuttle. As we continue to watch, the threads blend one into the other, a fabric appears, and on the fabric, behold, a pattern emerges. In a similar manner, Al Huang has created a beautiful tapestry from his own epistemological loom. Physics equals Wu Li. Wu Li equals patterns of organic energy. Wu Li equals my way. Wu Li equals nonsense. Wu Li equals I clutch my ideas. Wu Li equals enlightenment. Each of the physicists at the conference to a person reported a resonance with this rich metaphor. Here at last was the vehicle through which we could present the seminal elements of advanced physics. By the end of the week, everyone at Esalen was talking about Wu Li. At the same time that this was happening, I was trying to find out what a master is. The dictionary was no help. All of its definitions involved an element of control. This did not fit easily into our image of the dancing Wu Li masters. Since Al Huang is a Tai Chi master, I asked him. That is the word that other people use to describe me, he said. To Al Huang was just Al Huang. Later in the week, I asked him the same question again, hoping to get a more tangible answer. A master is someone who started before you did, was what I got that time. My Western education left me unable to accept a non-definition for my definition of a master, so I began to read Huang's book, Embrace Tiger, Return to Mountain. There, in the foreword by Alan Watts, in a paragraph describing Al Huang, I found what I sought. Said Alan Watts of Al Huang, "He begins from the center and not from the fringe. He imparts an understanding of the basic principles of the art before going on to the meticulous details, and he refuses to break down the Tai Chi movements into a 1-2-3 drill so as to make the student into a robot. The traditional way is to teach by rote and to give the impression that long periods of boredom are the most essential part of training. In that way, a student may go on for years and years without ever getting the feel of what he is doing." Here was just the definition of a master that I sought. A master teaches essence. When the essence is perceived, he teaches what is necessary to expand the perception. The Wu Li master does not speak of gravity until the student stands in wonder at the flower petal falling to the ground. He does not speak of laws until the student of his own says, "How strange! I dropped 2 stones simultaneously, one heavy and one light, and both of them reached the earth at the same moment." He does not speak of mathematics until the student says, "There must be a way to express this more simply." In this way, the Wu Li master dances with his student. The Wu Li master does not teach, but the student learns. The Wu Li master always begins at the center, at the heart of the matter. This is the approach that we take in this book. It is written for intelligent people who want to know about advanced physics, but who are ignorant of its terminology and perhaps of its mathematics. The Dancing Wooly Masters is a book of essence, the essence of quantum mechanics, quantum logic, special relativity, general relativity, and some new ideas that indicate the direction that physics seems to be moving. Of course, who can know where the future goes? The only surety is that what we think today will be a part of the past tomorrow. Therefore, this book deals not with knowledge, which is always past tense anyway, but with imagination, which is physics come alive, which is Wu Li. One of the greatest physicists of all, Albert Einstein, was perhaps a Wu Li master. In 1938 he wrote, "Physical concepts are free creations of the human mind and are not, however it may seem, uniquely determined by the external world. In our endeavor to understand reality, we are somewhat like a man trying to understand the mechanism of a closed watch. He sees the face and the moving hands, even hears it ticking, but he has no way of opening the case. If he is ingenious, he may form some picture of a mechanism which could be responsible for all the things he observes, but he may never be quite sure his picture is the only one which could explain his observations. He will never be able to compare his picture with the real mechanism, and he cannot even imagine the possibility of the meaning of such a comparison." Most people believe that physicists are explaining the world. Some physicists even believe that, but the Wu Li masters know that they are only dancing with it. I asked Huang how he structures his classes. "Every lesson is the first lesson," he told me. "Every time we dance, we do it for the first time." "But surely you cannot be starting new each lesson," I said. "Lesson number two must be built on what you taught in lesson number one, and lesson three likewise must be built on lessons one and two, and so on." "When I say that every lesson is the first lesson," he replied, "it does not mean that we forget what we already know. It means that what we are doing is always new, because we are always doing it for the first time." This is another characteristic of a master. Whatever he does with the enthusiasm of doing it for the first time. This is the source of his unlimited energy. Every lesson that he teaches or learns is a first lesson. Every dance that he dances for the first time. It is always new, personal, and alive. Isidore I. Rabi, Nobel Prize winner in physics and the former chairman of the physics department at Columbia University, wrote, "We don't teach our students enough of the intellectual content of experiments, their novelty and their capacity for opening new fields. My own view is that you take these things personally. You do an experiment because your own philosophy makes you want to know the result. It's too hard and life is too short to spend your time doing something because someone else has said it's important. You must feel the thing yourself." Unfortunately, most physicists are not like Rabi. The majority of them, in fact, do spend their lives doing what other people have told them is important. That was the point Rabi was making. This brings us to a common misunderstanding. When most people say scientist, they mean technician. A technician is a highly trained person whose job is to apply known techniques and principles. He deals with the known. A scientist is a person who seeks to know the true nature of physical reality. He deals with the unknown. In short, scientists discover and technicians apply. However, it is no longer evident whether scientists really discover new things or whether they create them. Many people believe that discovery is actually an act of creation. If this is so, then the distinction between scientists, poets, painters, and writers is not clear. In fact, it is possible that scientists, poets, painters, and writers are all members of the same family of people whose gift it is by nature to take those things which we call commonplace and to represent them to us in such ways that our self-imposed limitations are expanded. Those people in whom this gift is especially pronounced, we call geniuses. The fact is that most scientists are technicians. They are not interested in the essentially new. Their field of vision is relatively narrow. Their energies are directed toward applying what is already known. Because their noses often are buried in the bark of a particular tree, it is difficult to speak meaningfully to them of forests. the case of the mysterious hydrogen spectrum illustrates the difference between scientists and technicians. When a white light, such as sunlight, enters a glass prism, one of the most beautiful of phenomena occurs. Out the other side of the prism comes not white light, but every color in the rainbow, from dark red to light violet, with orange, yellow, green, and blue in between. This is because white light is made of all these different colors. It is a combination, whereas red light contains only red light, green light contains only green light, etc. Isaac Newton wrote his famous Optics about this phenomenon 300 years ago. This display of colors is called a white light spectrum. The spectral analysis of white light shows a complete spectrum because white light contains all of the colors that our eyes can see, and some that they cannot see, like infrared and ultraviolet. However, not every spectral analysis produces a complete spectrum. If we take one of the chemical elements, for example, like sodium, cause it to emit light and shine that light through a glass prism, we get only part of a complete spectrum. If an object is visible in a dark room, it is emitting light. If it appears red, for example, it is emitting red light. Light is emitted by excited objects. Exciting a piece of sodium does not mean offering it tickets to the Super Bowl. Exciting a piece of sodium means adding some energy to it. One way of doing this is to heat it. When we shine the light emitted by excited, incandescent, sodium through a prism or a spectroscope, we do not obtain the full array of colors characteristic of white light, but only parts of it. In the case of sodium, we obtain two thin yellow lines. We also can produce a negative image of the sodium spectrum by shining white light through sodium vapor to see what parts of the white light the sodium vapor absorbs. White light passing through sodium vapor and then through a spectroscope produces the whole rainbow of colors minus the two yellow lines emitted by incandescent sodium. Either way, the sodium spectrum always produces the same distinct pattern. It may be composed of black lines on an otherwise complete spectrum of colors, or it may be composed of colored lines without the rest of the spectrum, but it always remains the same. This pattern is the fingerprint of the element sodium. Each element emits or absorbs only specific colors. Likewise, each element produces a specific spectroscopic pattern which never varies. Footnote: in practice, some of the lines representing transitions between higher energy states do not appear in absorption spectra. End of footnote. Hydrogen is the simplest element. It seems to have only two components, a proton, which has a positive charge, and an electron, which has a negative charge. We must say it seems to have, because there is not one person alive who has ever seen a hydrogen atom. If hydrogen atoms exist, millions of them can exist on a pinhead, so small are they calculated to be. Hydrogen atoms, quote unquote, is a speculation about what is inside of the watch. We can say only that the existence of such entities nicely explains certain observations that would be very difficult to explain otherwise, barring explanations such as "the devil did it," which still may prove to be correct. It is this kind of explanation that drove Galileo, Newton, and Descartes to create what is now modern science. At one time, physicists thought that atoms were constructed in the following way. At the center of an atom is a nucleus, just as the sun is at the center of our solar system. In the nucleus is located almost all of the mass of the atom in the form of positively charged particles, protons, and particles about the same size as protons but without a charge, neutrons. Only hydrogen has no neutrons in its nucleus. Orbiting about the nucleus, as the planets orbit the sun, are electrons, which have almost no mass compared with the nucleus. Each electron has one negative charge. The number of electrons is always the same as the number of protons, so that the positive and negative charges cancel each other, and the atom, as a whole, has no charge. The problem with comparing this model of the atom with our solar system is that the distances between an atomic nucleus and its electrons are enormously greater than we picture the distances between the Sun and its planets. The space occupied by an atom is so huge, compared with the mass of its particles, almost all of which is in the nucleus, that the electrons orbiting the nucleus are like a few flies in a cathedral, according to Ernest Rutherford, who created this model of the atom.